Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. I'm your host, Dr. Dave O'Brien from City University London. On this episode, we're speaking to Patricia Ventura, who's from Spelman College in the United States, and she's written a book called Neoliberal Culture, Living with American Neoliberalism. It was published by Ashgate in 2012. Okay, welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. I'm here with Patricia Ventura, who's from Spelman College in the United States, and we're going to talk about her new book, Neoliberal Culture, Living with American Neoliberalism. So welcome to the podcast, Patricia. And I think could we kick off by, if you could tell the listeners a little bit about yourself, sort of your position at Spelman and your sort of academic background.
All right. Yes. Thanks for having me. I am an associate professor at Spelman's English department. My area is cultural studies and visual culture, which is a pretty broad catch-all term, right? So I have a lot of interest just trying to all come together to understand how people live their everyday lives in the U.S. context, because I'm in American studies as well as cultural studies, and kind of just like the trying to get to, especially like in relation to my teaching, trying to get my students to be aware of those things that they just take for granted, the habitual, you know, routinized parts of their daily life. So I try to increase their awareness, and then my book project arises out of that desire to offer a kind of critical perspective on everyday life as well. Spelman's an interesting place. We are a historically black women's college in Atlanta and liberal arts college. And so we have a population of students who are very much affected by the rise of neoliberalism because, you know, you see the way it impacts anyone who is kind of trying to have a more, say, aspirational perspective on college rather than, you know, just coming from a tradition of a lot of kids who had their parents, grandparents, et cetera, go to college. A lot of my students are first-generation students. So, you know, this project is personal on that level as well.
Yeah, it's really interesting, actually, that you kind of pick up on what I guess is the kind of the classic job or role of cultural studies is to kind of get people to think about what they assume is common sense in a different or much more critical way. And that's one of the things that that I found really interesting in the way that you start the book, which was kind of going back to I suppose, an older tradition of cultural studies with this idea about structures of feeling and the way that neoliberalism has a particular kind of way it structures everyday life. And I wonder if we can start there in terms of the book's project and what made you kind of use that idea of a structure of feeling and how come you started with that particular theoretical construct to get a grip or an idea of neoliberalism?
Well, I mean, you know, the project for me really evolved out of work that I had done with my dissertation on globalization.
Right.
And that was where I started, and I realized this is just one component of something larger as I, you know, decided to keep thinking about the questions I had started with about changes that were happening in the U.S. as a result of the end of the Cold War, which is where the project had started. And so I really saw that I could address these large, you know, almost in some ways unfathomable changes because they were so massive by thinking of just how they're lived in individuals' lives and kind of social experiences that are not even recognized, you know, as social, which is part of the way Williams talks about structure of feeling.
Yeah, it's really interesting to see that, I guess, that kind of English tradition that was applied, you know, to very sort of British questions by Williams, see it kind of come up against these really, you know, sort of American cultural questions. And I found it particularly interesting the way that played out with other theoretical areas as well. So I thought the work of Michel Foucault was really important to the book, and you sort of draw on governmentality and biopower as well. So could you say a little bit about how you use those two ideas in the text?
Well, so, you know, I feel like really, if we want to talk about the way neoliberalism is in this cultural perspective, I felt like I had to bring together, if you want to put it in terms of two major philosophical or political traditions, I guess I would think of, or in terms of theorists, because we're talking about Foucault,
yeah,
I would bring Foucault together with Harvey. And felt like David Harvey, sorry. So I felt like I had to think about those kind of larger economic or globalization questions in relation to just how populations are regulated, which is the, gets me to the biopower piece, right? So, and in the question of governmentality, which obviously is central to Foucault, you know, I was thinking about, well, what marks neoliberalism in the US? And it's really about that kind of care administered to corporations rather than to individuals, right? So the pastoral care that Foucault talks about is something that, you know, made the government, state, national and state governments so important to individuals' lives, actually gets transferred to corporations, and citizens and, you know, right, quote unquote, regular people are told, oh, no, this is good, right? It's going to make you have a better job, and the economy's going to improve if we help these corporations and give them tax breaks or build a big stadium for some sports team. And, you know, of course, it never, well, never, it rarely, you know, trickles down the way they say it does, but that's the big promise. So I felt like I had to put the economic together with these kind of regulation of populations, you know, and how that process works. So the Foucault with the Harvey is kind of a way to think about the project.
Yeah, I thought theoretically it was really interesting because obviously Harvey is quite a mainstream sort of Marxist scholar and, you know, draws on Marx centrally, and Foucault had that sort of complicated relationship with Marx and tries to distance himself. But it really made sense in the text, the way that to understand the political economy ideas that Harvey is talking about, you've got to understand both the structures of feeling, but also the way individuals are kind of regulated and, you know, are almost sort of brought into being. And I think that comes up, and we might talk about this a little later, came up in particularly in the chapters about the military and the invasion of Iraq as well, really. Really fascinatingly. So if I can turn to kind of, I guess, the core arguments in the book, which is that there are these particular components of neoliberalism, which I thought were a fascinating range that kind of underpin the neoliberal American sort of imagination or consciousness. So you sort of outline the erosion of governments, the role of globalization, corporatocracy, biopower, and then hyper-legality as well. And I wonder if we might sort of turn to them in relation to the chapters as well. So starting with maybe corporatocracy, because you touched on that in something you said earlier about the way corporations are treated as people, as individuals. But this plays out, for example, in your analysis of Oprah Winfrey's book club, yeah, and of Walmart as well.
Yeah, yeah. Right, so corporatocracy is, governmentality, or kind of a way in which corporations exercise significant power over the state. They become recipients of its care. And so I talk about, you know, Walmart, and Walmart's become a very, a touchstone for resisting this new liberal, of neoliberal, the new economy, some call it, whatever, however you want to think of it. It's become a touchstone for resisting neoliberal capitalism in the U.S. context, and I think in other parts of the world as well, you know. And so what we find, though, when we look at Walmart is the way that, in fact, it's, you know, to use the derogatory term that Republicans use for recipients of public assistance here in the U.S., it is a welfare queen. Mm. It receives so much indirect and in some cases direct support from governments, right? So it pays insanely low wages and recommends to its employees, hey, why don't you go get, welfare? You definitely qualify. And there have been cases of Walmart managers handing out the paperwork required to apply for public assistance. So it is a beneficiary in a direct way of the welfare state, even as, the Walton family really are well known to be very politically conservative, Republican types, who, of course, their whole platform in the U.S. context is all about ending the welfare state, right? So it's not in any way, it doesn't really make a lot of sense if you think about it, but there's just so much kind of a rhetoric around these areas, right? So the welfare recipient, oh, they don't work, they're lazy. But on the other hand, the welfare recipients are people who work at Walmart, for instance, right? So this is just one component of this process. But I'm trying to put together these various strands, and there's a lot I know that I'm touching on in the book. But I'm trying to hopefully give a model for how to do neoliberal cultural analysis in the U.S. context, or how I think it would be, potentially useful to do it. And also to run some of those studies myself through some major figures like Oprah and Walmart.
Yeah, because the same political economy analysis is true over here in the UK at the moment, whereby much of the welfare state is to do with supporting people who are in work and are being paid very, very poorly, as opposed to the kind of, the cultural figure of someone who is out of work and is receiving what they call welfare in the States or social security here in the UK. But really interestingly, I think is that kind of that cultural question of where Oprah's book club and the use of the book Where the Heart Is kind of ties into this this political economy story.
Okay, right. So in this chapter, what I do is I talk about, I want to think about the way Walmart plays such a central role in U.S. life today. One in five Americans goes to a Walmart once a week. So this is a pretty major. It's not only is it a place where people shop, it's a survival strategy for a lot of people too, because the stuff they sell is quite cheap too. So it causes the problem and also helps people deal with the problem.
Mm, yeah.
But I wanted to think about Walmart, and there is a book called Where the Heart Is, which is part of was one of the more popular books in the original run of Oprah's book club. Now, I wanted to talk about Oprah's book club because I really wanted to think about literature. So I wanted to talk about, so many strands come together. I wanted to talk about shopping and consumer behavior. I wanted to think about reading practices, just again, the way people live their everyday lives. So Oprah's book club was a very important part of people's reading practices in the U.S. And still is, but the show is not in production anymore, but it's, she is a very active internet fan base too. So I wanted to think about these everyday life practices, shopping, reading, and I found I could actually put them together in one chapter in a way that I hope is productive by thinking about this book, Where the Heart Is, which is about a young woman who is stranded by her boyfriend at a Walmart while she's pregnant. And so she just lives in the Walmart. No one knows she's living there, and has her baby at the Walmart. And then she names the baby America's Nation, which is just awful. I mean, this is not a great book, but it's an important book, not only because it was the first Oprah book to be made into a film, but it also is on a lot of reading lists for a middle school kid. So, these kind of cheesy narratives actually carry a lot of weight and a lot of symbolic significance. And in the book, not only does she have the baby at Walmart, she works at Walmart, and Sam Walton appears because this book was set in the early 90s, and this is before he died. He died in 92. Sam Walton appears and gives her a little bit of cash. And, you know, it's just so absurd. And they treat him like he's some kind of, you know, saint.
Yeah.
And it's crazy. But he apparently was beloved by people, you know. And so in that sense, I guess it reflected something. And so I wanted to show how these strands all kind of weave together in one place. But, you know, Oprah herself, in that chapter, I talk about what an important figure she is for neoliberal culture as well, because she teaches her fans and viewers how to kind of manage themselves, you know, to create life plans to make them the best them they could be. And so she's an important figure as well, I think. And of course, both Walton and Winfrey are, you know, these kind of seen as people's friends, but they're also, of course, they're among the richest people. Well, Walton is dead, but his family are among the richest people in the world. Oprah is among the richest people in the world. So these are not, even though they seem like just us folks, they're very much removed from day-to-day life that most people understand.
And it's fascinating how these sorts of cultural questions don't stop at the level of, I guess, the kind of the popular novel or the television show either. When you talk about the kind of the erosion of governments, one of your chapters has got the example of Las Vegas as another site where not just kind of, you know, the sort of corporatocracy plays itself out, but the kind of erosion and collapse of the government structures that really sort of sustained the United States after the Cold War.
So, yeah, so the Las Vegas work is, again, if I'm trying to understand how, you know, everyday life, I think Las Vegas is this kind of fantasy vacation of everyday Americana. So this is the place where supposedly you get away from your everyday life, but it's one of the most popular places to go. So it's the, you know, the common place to be uncommon, if you want to think of it that way, if that makes sense. So Las Vegas is this really interesting place. And, you know, it, not only in that way, but because my original work, I started thinking about Las Vegas because I was really trying to understand postmodernity and where it fits into all this. That's where I originally started long, long, long time ago. And I started reading, thinking about Las Vegas, reading about Las Vegas, visiting Vegas often, and realizing, my goodness, this is a caricature of globalization. And so that's where I started thinking about, you know, this kind of globalization piece of this puzzle that I'm trying to put together as neoliberal culture. And Vegas, really, to me, it not only does it caricature it in terms of the hotel construction that was very popular in the 90s, which I say is the first decade of the neoliberal culture era, but, you know, it lives it out through its the people who work there. So, you know, there's immigrant labor is a huge part of what makes Las Vegas and most of America possible, right? Any kind of service sector employment is made possible by immigrant labor in the U.S.
Yeah, and immigrant labor is sort of central in many ways to the book as well, because you deal with the sort of, I guess, the other side of America in the sense of Mexico as being the source of both a lot of fears for the American middle class that are expressed both kind of politically and culturally, but also in terms of real practicalities, as you identify the fact that contemporary America just couldn't function without the levels of immigrant labor that it enjoys. And this, I thought was particularly interesting. You used the term hyperlegality several times in the book, and it becomes really important in the chapter on poverty and the welfare state. So I don't know if you could sort of pin that down.
Right. So hyperlegality is the exercise of control by kind of creating extensive new legal classifications or, you know, say enforcing trifling ones. The classic example from a legal theorist, Nasser Hussain, says that it's the spitting on the ground strategy that Robert Kennedy used to attack the mob. You know, if they do any little thing, we're going to bust them for that. And so this hyper-legality becomes really, I think, important in terms of thinking about welfare. And of course, I mean, you know, talking about welfare in relation to neoliberalism, right, I'm not creating some new connection there. This is an obvious connection. But so I wanted to think about how that works out, though, in terms of, again, these larger structures in which people live. And so what I found is that it's actually, you know, part of this whole family values rhetoric that's really important to understand neoliberalism, because family becomes the one of the substitutes for the state, for social reproduction, you know, enabled by, say, you know, all of us putting our money into the general tax fund, and then, you know, we have better schools or something like that, we have better health, we have health care. This is meant to be eroded in neoliberalism so that the family is all that's left. And so what hyperlegality does, I think, is tries to impose family values through, you know, encouraging them through law, encouraging people to be married, through welfare reform law, which, you know, you think here's a private decision, but the law absolutely, right, promotes that. And promotes it as a strategy for combating poverty, as opposed to thinking about it as a social problem. Well, the problem of poverty is caused by bad people, and they have bad family values, and so we need to find a way to give them good family values. You know, it's very simplistic logic, and it basically blames the poor for their poverty without ever taking any kind of larger social view. And I think that's pretty common in the U.S.
Yeah, yeah, and it seemed very sort of contradictory as well. This figure of the family that, on the one hand, and I think this is, you know, something that comes up quite a lot in studies of both neoliberalism generally, but also its manifestations in America in particular, the way that there's this kind of insistence on a particular kind of family values that go hand in hand with a really strong insistence on the individual. And, you know, that thing you were saying about Oprah, the idea of sort of making yourself the best person you can be, you know, kind of striving to fulfill one's potential. To use the kind of Foucauldian ideas of regulating oneself to be, you know, a sort of a good functioning sort of social unit, whilst at the same time that, you know, there's this insistence on particular forms of conduct and behaviour that are bound up with the family and, you know, the kind of, I guess, the traditional values of an America of almost the 1950s rather than the 1970s or even the 1990s.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And I mean, you know, family, what the definition of family is, of course, is changing all the time and changing quickly and will change, I think, in response to terrible economic stressors that the poor experience and that the middle class experience here in the U.S. and, of course, throughout the world.
Yeah, and it was fascinating, that dividing line, actually, that the sort of the figure of the family, certainly in the fourth chapter, didn't seem to be, you know, it's kind of only about regulating the poor, but also it seemed to have a really important role in regulating the middle class as well, giving them an identity that, you know, wasn't those people who they define as poor, you know, wasn't those people who were, you know, maybe involved in the welfare system, but actually at the same time they were facing a lot of the precariousness and uncertainties as the people they were trying to kind of make themselves distinct and socially distant from.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, they've done surveys and most Americans think that they don't receive, which is crazy. Most Americans think they don't receive any kind of social welfare benefit. I mean, not even you know, cause they think, oh, welfare, poor people, bad people. Okay. I'm not that. That's cause that's the cliche. Right. But, most people, if you ask them, they have received, you know, what benefits in the form of how of help with getting first mortgages, with student loan assistance. You know, these are common middle class assistance, but that doesn't get called that, doesn't have that stigma and that label.
Yeah, it's seen as being, you know, sort of absolutely acceptable because it doesn't have the, as you identify in the book, the kind of the cultural baggage of other forms of government assistance.
Right. And yeah, so the welfare reform is, you know, again, it's essential part of neoliberal strategy, but there's just this kind of meanness to it that's, I think, really stunning in the sense of, you know, just testing welfare recipients to see if they're on drugs. Just the assumption that they're absolutely drug addicts and that's why that they are poor. Well, you know, there's no testing for you if you're getting assistance with your mortgage. There's no testing to see if you're on drugs.
Yeah, and it seems to conflict as well with that other side of the sort of legal constitutional. And again, you give a couple of examples. Tradition in the States that, you know, is bound up with particular kinds of freedom that sometimes neoliberalism in the States seems to be promoting around sort of freedom of individuals, but at the same time is, and I think you draw on Agamben's states of exception ideas here, but is saying that there are large parts or large groups of people in American society that just, they aren't really people. They aren't really citizens. So they shouldn't be kind of given the same legal rights and status as everybody else.
Right. That's right. Yeah. And I mean, and just little things too, in terms of returning back to the family values. One of the things I just thought was so interesting as I was doing some research on the way family values rhetoric plays out in people's lives was just, you know, how marriage is an aspiration rather than, you know, well, we're going to get married. No, you have to earn the right to be married by having some kind of economic stability. I found that really interesting because, of course, marriage is being promoted in the, you know, the act, that the law that created the welfare reform, you know, policies as a way to get out of poverty. But for the impoverished, it's actually something you earn once you've gotten out of poverty.
Yeah, but it's that sort of it's the liberal bit in the neoliberal that, you know, much of this would be sort of in keeping with Victorian England, except for the fact it's being played out in very new ways in the States. And I guess that might take me sort of into the final chapter of the book, actually, where a lot of these themes come together, where you analyze both the invasion of Iraq under George W. Bush and some of the cultural representations, particularly a film, Gunner's Palace. And I'm interested to see how the kind of broader themes of the text actually play out in that final chapter.
Yeah. And again, I know there's a lot of strands that are getting woven together in book, a lot. But I really, again, was trying to figure out this day-to-day life. And I couldn't analyze life in the first decade of the 2000s without analyzing the Iraq War. And, you know, still would analyze it today, right? I mean, it's Afghanistan, you know, more than Iraq. But, I mean, drone warfare more than Iraq, too. But I mean, these are just this kind of the imperialism of that war signaled something, right? So I really needed to see that and understand that better to really talk about neoliberal culture in the U.S., and so, yeah, so I started looking into the, again, I try to use some kind of artifact, some object that will ground my analysis. So we've talked about Vegas, we've talked about, you know, Walmart. For this work to try to think about the U.S., you know, in imperialist relations, I chose the first documentary that was released in theaters about troops in the Iraq War. It's called Gunner Palace. And so I started analyzing that, and you know, it looked like an episode of Cops. Do you know Cops?
Yeah.
All right, so it looked like Cops, and in fact, that's basically was Cops writ large. So what I think about the documentary, and so you know, you see then this kind of law and order ideology that undergirds Cops, which is, oh yeah, you know, it's the cops, they're the good guys because we're riding along with them. And if they go and stop somebody, then that person's guilty. We don't see how many of the people that they arrest are actually guilty or found guilty of anything. But that's just the assumption. And so, again, it's the same way in which the war got promoted in the U.S. If the troops are there, then that's where we need to be. And that's then the people that troops are fighting must be the bad guys because the troops are the good guys. And it's this very simple logic. And when the logic start, when the evidence is clear that it's not that simple, then the U.S. news media just doesn't cover it anymore because the troops are sacred, right? So you can't do anything that says maybe their lives are being risked for no good reason. Well, you know, no good reason for them. Certainly there's a lot of corporations that made money from this war. But if there's no good reason for the war, then we can't, you know, do anything in the media. We can't really talk about that. So we just stop talking about it. That's kind of seems to be the approach for the way that U.S. wars are represented. But anyway, so that's what I was trying to think about then. So talking about this documentary and then the larger issues of the war itself. And yeah.
And the big cultural contrast is I guess with the 70s and early 80s, where the cultural response to Vietnam was exceptionally critical by both news media and things like Hollywood, whereas that just doesn't seem to have happened at all with the cultural analysis you offer of the Iraq invasion.
Well, I mean, there was a lot of work done to make the Vietnam War be actually a story about how the American people failed the American troops as opposed to anything else that the war was about.
Yes.
So that's the dominant narrative in the U.S. about Vietnam, is that the troops, our U.S. troops, suffered because, you know, damn hippies were spitting on them. I mean, that's, that's the narrative, which there's no evidence of anyone ever having spat upon the troops, but that's the story that's out there. And so that the idea is that the U.S. people owe the troops from Vietnam support for all wars. Again, that doesn't make sense. Of course, the average Vietnam vet doesn't deserve to be spat upon. No one's saying that. No one even thinks that. But the logic plays out in terms of the rhetoric around war. Then is that in order to support these brave people, we have to support the war itself. And it all starts from the rhetoric about the Vietnam War.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things that was quite nice about the book, which, I mean, as you can sort of gather as a listener from the last half an hour, that, you know, neoliberalism in America is deeply divisive. It has really, you know, sort of horrible consequences for the people who are on the receiving end of its ideologies. And, you know, it's not a good thing that's happened to the States. But you finish with a kind of a couple of hopeful examples in the conclusion, which I thought was quite nice and was quite unusual for a critical theory book as well, which tends to just have the pessimistic analysis. So the slow food movement that kind of originates in Europe, and then the food not bombs idea, I thought were two really nice and sort of hopeful things to end on. So I don't know if you could say a couple of things about those too.
Yeah, and can I just say, in terms of the other chapters, you know, there are kind of utopian elements in the other chapters I would say, because I think, you know, I think there's always that present in any kind of cultural formation that is popular. I thought, you know, that's Jameson talks about, Frederick Jameson talks.
Yeah.
And I think that's right, you know. So you know, in the Las Vegas chapter, I talk a little bit about the very strong union movement that's there, you know. And these are small things, but they matter, right? So, but in the last chapter, I talk about food politics, and I knew when I was doing it that there are so many people will just roll their eyes, and I understand that, but I also understand that people are where they are and they feel the need to do something. And I think that it's easy to just roll your eyes. And, you know, I've seen a t-shirt, it's funny, but it says Goldman Sachs doesn't care if you raise chickens. And I think it's a funny t-shirt, but if they don't care, I think the person who's raising the chickens cares. And I think that that's valid, you know, and I don't want to discount these individual efforts as well. And I do think also, of course, they're very vital too, depending on how far you take them. So something like Food Not Bombs is an organization that of cleaners, people who are trying to opt out of consumption, well, not opt out completely, but trying to create a model of and an emblem and a symbol of people who are trying to feed the hungry without talking about it as charity, but saying this is a public responsibility and connecting poverty and hunger to U.S. military policy and those are connected. And I think a name like Food Not Bombs illustrates that very nicely. And so, you know, I show these people who there are people out there trying to live differently. And yes, they're not changing the system in a revolutionary way, but they're creating alternative visions. And, you know, as I say in that conclusion, you know, the South America and Central America is where the changes really are probably happening. But, you know, I'm talking about the U.S. and what people in the U.S. context do. And so these are, you know, food politics has become a site for trying to think differently. So,
yeah, totally. I wonder, is that kind of note of optimism carried forward into what you're working on at the moment, or have you decided to sort of leave neoliberalism aside for the moment? What's your kind of current intellectual project?
Yeah, no, there's no optimism. I'm depressed. I'm talking about, well, it's okay. It's the model for how I work is, you know, I try to talk about everyday life,
yep,
popular culture, and then try to see it in these connections to these bigger ideas. So right now I'm writing about a show. I don't know if you know the show. It's called Scandal.
I've heard of it. Yeah. But it might be on a UK television channel. Yeah.
Yeah, it's, well, you know, it's interesting too. I started watching it because I knew my students would watch it when the show first came on, because it's the first primetime drama in like 40 years to be about an African-American woman. Mm. I told you my students are African-American women. So I'm like, well, I have to watch this show. And Scandal stars Kerry Washington, the actress, and she plays this DC kind of fixer, a person who cleans up scandals, you know, is a power broker. And she also, it's so funny, she also happens to be having an affair with the president, who is white in the show. So there's so many issues being touched on. But within this, there also are, you know, it turns out her dad is the head of this so funny. Her dad is the head of this super spy agency that's not the CIA. It's secret. No one knows. It's secret, more secretive than the CIA. And they deal with torture. They deal with the kind of these really critical issues that the U.S. population or the U.S. political, you know, scene is dealing with, I should say. Mm. But they deal with it in this melodrama. This is a melodrama. And so I really love thinking about the role this show plays in staging many of the contemporary cultural and political questions that are out there with this particular cast, which is, as I said, the first African-American woman in primetime in the U.S. in a primetime show in a major network. So, you know, so it's a touchstone, really. And so I'm talking about that in relation to problems of torture and representations of torture, political torture, because they do that just like on the show 24.
Which yeah.
They deal with that, but you see it in a very different way because the creator of the show is in fact an African-American woman herself who's pretty, I think, politically conscious. So they have torture, but they also show it in a very different light. And so I'm talking about the representation of social death and torture in relation to this particular cast of, you know, how it's different when it's an African American woman at the center of the action rather than, say, Jack Bauer, you know.
Yeah.
So so that's what I'm working on right now. And so yeah.
And are you going to sort of build that up into a book project? Or?
Right now, I would like it to be part of a larger project about necropolitics and social death. You know, I've also written another chapter about the Coen brothers' Burn After Reading.
Yeah.
Which is just a great, I think, great send-up on the whole Bush years.
It's a very, very funny film as well.
Yeah. So I'm putting it in that context of just trying to really think more about necropolitics. So really it grows out of my chapter on the Iraq War. So neoliberalism's always there, but I'm not staging it in the same way, because in this book that we're talking about, I was really trying to develop a model for analyzing neoliberal culture in the U.S. as well as doing that analysis. And so here I'm taking one of those pieces and trying to really run with it.
Great. I look forward to seeing how that project develops. It sounds really
Me too. it takes a lot of time, as you know.
Yeah, of course. And it's always sort of difficult when, you know, you're just at the sort of the ideas into writing stage and you're wondering, where is it going to go? Will it be a book? Will it be a series of papers? Will it all come together? Yeah. It's tricky.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thanks very much for taking the time to chat to us.
Oh, thank you. Thanks. I really enjoyed it.
So you've been listening to me, your host, Dr. Dave O'Brien from City University London, speaking to Patricia Ventura from Spelman College. And we've been discussing her book, Neoliberal Culture, Living with American Neoliberalism. Thanks for listening to New Books in Critical Theory, and we'll speak to you next time.